Parshas Achrimos. First big chunk is the service of Yom Kippur. People might be familiar with this from the laning of Yom Kippur, the Avodah of Yom Kippur, Seches Yoma, and so on. I want to discuss here one somewhat unusual, striking feature of the Avodah. That is the Goral, the lottery that was performed to select which of the two Seirim would go LaHashem and which would go LaZazel. It's a fairly unusual thing. We have a lot of halachas of karbanos, the whole Chumash Vayikra. There are all kinds of procedures and things you do. Goral is a fairly unusual thing to do. As a matter of fact, Goral appears in general beyond karbanos about 6 times in Tanakh. Most of you can probably guess at least a few of them. I've included the 6 prominent cases of Goral here in number 1. There is the Goral of the two Seirim, of Yom Kippur. There is the Goral of the division of Eretz Yisrael, which was discussed in Parshas Pinchas and later implemented in Sefer Yoshua. There is the Goral of Achan, when Achan, the beginning of Sefer Yoshua, violates the Cherem, and they want to find out who did it, so they do a Goral procedure, which eventually singles out Achan. Achan then confesses that he did it under solicitation by Yoshua. There is a similar Goral in Sefer Shmuel. It says that Shaul got wind from Hashem that they shouldn't pursue a certain battle. They realize it's because someone had done something wrong. Turned out it was Yonas and his son who had tasted something in violation of a tannis that Shaul had decreed. She hadn't known about it, but again, it says the procedure they did involved some kind of goral to determine who was the guilty one, so to speak. The last two goralos happened somewhat later. Both of them, again, occur in various kriyas of Tanakh that we have. One, again, back to Yom Kippur, is Yonah. Right at the beginning there, it says that the ship is foundering, and they want to figure out why is this unusual, terrible storm afflicting the ship. Turned out they did a goral. It says that they said, L'chuvena pila goralos, v'neda b'shalmihara azos, why is this happening? And it singled out Yonah. And the last one, of course, is Haman. It says Haman wanted to know what day should he perpetrate genocide on, and the answer was the 13th of Adar. I don't think it says Goral. I think it just says you pick one and you take two and you pick one. That's the point. It doesn't specify how it's supposed to be done. The Yom Kippur is unique in that the Torah specifies that it be done via a Goral. So, of these Goralos, just to break them down, 4 of them are done by Jews, 2 by non-Jews. The sailors in Yonah and Haman were non-Jews. 3 of them were to single out who a guilty party was. Achan and Yonasan and Yonah. The other ones were just kind of, two of the other ones, the Sawyer and the division of the Arat, was just a kind of procedure to choose between 2 apparently equivalent alternatives. Several of these were commanded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Shnei Seirim, the Chalukas Ha'aretz was God's commandment. Some of them were just proposed, the initiative was taken by people themselves. In any event, these are the 6 basic cases of Goral. There are a couple of other passing references to Goral in Tanakh, but these are the 6 basic cases where Goralos were actually performed or commanded or both by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I know this again, as usual, not because I'm such an expert in Tanakh, but because as the evening goes on, we'll discuss the various references in the halakhic literature and the rabbinic literature to Goral, then they all come back to these basic 6 stories where the post can try to derive various rules, various principles, various guidelines of Goral, and the constant references are to these 6 cases. Now, the fundamental question that the post can debate, really, is what exactly is a Goral? Is it simply like a coin toss to decide, who gets to receive the ball first? Is it just, we have to pick some way, you have to have some way of doing it, so we'll have to just flip a coin and see which way it goes? Or is there something more theologically significant? Do we view this as some kind of communication from God? Do we believe that we're somehow channeling God's will by doing the Goral? So there are conflicting sources about this. One of the earliest, somewhat problematic sources is a very brief and very cryptic comment in the Gaonic Responsa. The Gaonim were talking about dividing up property. We mentioned one of the 6 Goralos was the Chalukas Haaretz, the dividing up Eretz Yisrael among the Jews entering Eretz Canaan. This is actually Lahalacha. This is in Baba Basra and then Shulchan Aruch, Chashon Mishpat. This is still the rule, still brought down in Halacha. If you have to divide up property, So you parcel out the land, let's say, into equivalent parcels, whether equivalent in dimensions or equivalent in value or whatever it is, but you parcel out the land into different parcels that are perceived as equivalent. Then if they can't agree which of the two partners or brothers, which of the two heirs takes which, you do a garul. So the Gaonim were exhorting you to take this very seriously. They said, Mapilun garulos, and the garul is the last word on the subject. No one has permission, the Gaonim said, to violate the garul, to diverge from whatever the garul says. Ein ha-garul el mipi shamayim. The garul is expressing the will of heaven. It brings the pasuk of garul for the division of the aretz. Ha'over el ha-garul ka'over el aseres ha-dibros. One who violates the garul is as though he has violated the Ten Commandments. A very problematic, very strange thing to say. I didn't cite the literature here, but many achronim raised eyebrows at this comment. They all said pretty much the same thing. V'hu pele, v'hu zar, v'hu tamua. What on earth? I mean, what on earth has this garul have to do with the aseres ha-dibros? At the very least, the garul. Los Achmad, you mean any procedure, whether it would have been a coin toss or any just arbitrary procedure, once the halacha is this way, you're saying, at that point, you're trying to take property that doesn't belong to you, at that point, it's Los Achmad, maybe Los Igzel. I guess you could say that. That's an interesting way of looking at it. The other Acharim seem to assume that the Gaonim meant that the Garul is somehow expressive of God's will, but why should it be that way? Why should it be as important as the Ten Commandments? So again, it's a very cryptic statement to the Gaonim. One or two of the later Acharonim go so far as to say that we're not even sure this is an authentic tshuva. You know, as usual, the provenance of the early literature sometimes is a little bit up in the air. But in any event, this is a widely quoted ruling of the Gaonim that you have to take a garul very, very seriously. And if you don't, it is as though you have violated the Ten Commandments. We also have a very strange, again, a very somewhat cryptic comment of Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam. Rabbi Avraham, the Rambam's one son, famous son, is always an interesting and somewhat more complex figure than one sometimes realizes. On the one hand, we know of him as the shield bearer of his father and the great fights of when the Rambam was attacked by the more conservative schools of thought. Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam was a vehement and extremely passionate defender of his father, defender of his father's philosophical tradition, of his rationalism. We sometimes might assume that Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam was a philosopher like his father. He certainly revered his father and adopted many of his views, but he was not the same person. If you read the contemporary scholarly literature, they're going on and on about how Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam was an adherent of Sufi mysticism, whatever that is. I'm not expert enough in the Islamic traditions to really know exactly what the Sufis believe, but Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam, we do know from his published work, in addition to his having a strong affinity and reverence for his father's rationalism, also had a strong strain of mysticism or of, it's hard to know what to call it exactly, and that you kind of see from this tshuva, an interesting mixture of the mystical and the rationalistic. Someone asked the Rebbe of Rambam, you always wonder what was going through the people's heads when they asked these questions. The question was, teach us our master, hagarolos mahim, what are garolos, and how do you do them? How do they work? What are they? Kind of an open-ended question like that. That's what they wanted to know. So Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam says, a garul in Arabic is called al-kara. Can't tell you what that is. How do you do it? He says it's done either with little pieces of paper, like cards that have things written on them, names, or with luchos, tablets, different types of things, he says. And then he explains the theology, the doctrine of the garul. He says, yesh bo smach mal yedias anelam. There's some means by which a garul can grant us access to hidden, to esoteric information. We don't really understand it. We don't have a good theoretical model for it, but it's true. It works. So on the one hand, he's rationalistic enough to acknowledge that we lack a good, that this is a desideratum, to have a good theoretical model for it, which is lacking, unfortunately. On the other hand, he's pretty convinced that it actually works, that it isn't simply like a coin, like we understand the coin toss, that it is some kind of mystic mechanism for revealing hidden truths, although he can't really explain to you how exactly it works. So, most of the literature on garul we'll discuss tonight doesn't directly address the question of, is the garul mystical or is it just like a coin toss? Occasionally the poskim do. Jumping ahead all the way to the 20th century, there is a interesting tshuva of Rav Chaim David Alevi of Eretz Yisrael, Seilach HaRav. He was asked, basically there was a dispute in a shul they were giving out aliyos, and one faction wanted to do it as we commonly do it, via auctions or selling it. Another faction wanted to do it via garel. And the controversy swirled about the garel. One side said the garel is great. It gives us, it allows the will of God to manifest itself. It's a great procedure. The other side said, no, garel is superstitious. Garel is nonsense. It's not rational. So Rav Chaim David HaLevi basically kind of ends up in the middle. He says garel is a halakhically sanctioned, as we'll be discussing tonight, garel is a perfectly legitimate, time-honored, hallowed procedure for making decisions. However, it is not, don't think that you're actually channeling the mind of God, he said. That is not the case. We have no particular reason to believe that a garel reveals anything hidden, certainly not the mind of God. He quotes the Gaonim. He's the one who says he doesn't know if it's authentic. He says that they have no source, they have no logical argument, they just say it without any proof, and so on. And he argues at length that the garel should not be seen as revealing any kind of hidden truth or the mind of God. It's simply a convention, it's simply a procedure, a legitimate one, he says. It's one that has plenty of appearances in the Jewish and the halakhic tradition, but it's nothing more than a convention, and the way we understand the coin toss before a ball game or anything else, it shouldn't be seen as having any deeper significance. But the fact is, he's basically going up against significant early sources. Actually, this reminds me, a little while back, I prepared a monograph on the halacha of partnership. So when I was discussing garel appears in the laws of partnership, how to divide partnership assets. So I mentioned this as a dispute. I said we have the Gaonim, we have some early sources that say garel is actually a window into the mind of God. And on the other hand, we have a dissenting view of Chaim David HaLevi who says that it is not. So my editors, some distinguished Talmidei Chachamim, they said, and are these two equal sides? Is Rav Chaim David HaLevi really, does he carry as much weight and authoritative weight as the Gaonim, 1,000 years earlier? And no, he doesn't. But nevertheless, the fact is the comment to the Gaonim is somewhat problematic. It's cryptic. It's many Achronim have objected that they don't understand the Gaonim. So at the end of the day, it'd be one thing if it would be a Shulchan Aruch, it would be a Rambam. But given that these sources are all kind of a little bit off the beaten path, I think it's fair to say it's something of an open question as to whether we should view the garel, our garel. Now, everyone agrees that the garelos that were mandated by God may have, when the Gemara itself says, when they divided the land, it wasn't just a garel like coins. It says it was the Urim Batumim, there was Elazar HaKohen was there. The Medrash says, the Gemara says, the garel actually called out, it was animated by Hashem that called out who should get which parcel. So certainly the rabbinic tradition says that the garel, the historical garel of the Chalukas HaAretz, was not just a simple coin toss. And again, when Hashem said do it, then it works. And Hashem said do it, then there could be more going on. But with the garel that we do on our own, that we decide to resolve impasses by doing a garel, that I think it's fair to say there isn't quite a consensus as to whether that's anything more than a convention or whether it actually shows us something about the mind of God. Now, in the halakhic literature, the most famous tshuva about garel is probably a tshuva of the Chavos Yar. It's a very charming, full of color and detail. I didn't reproduce the whole thing here. It's kind of long. But the case was a bunch of his students or his friends, he says, on Purim, they were having some kind of party, and they had a raffle, as we sometimes do at parties. They were raffling off a silver goblet inlaid with gold, a valuable silver goblet. Everyone contributed. Everyone who was entering the raffle contributed an entrance fee, I think one Reich Taler. And this thing itself was worth apparently a number of Reich Taler, the pot essentially. And the way the garel was done, I don't know why they had such an overly complicated system, which, as we'll see, led to problems. But the system of the raffle was they had two pots, two hats, so to speak. In one of them were 12 pieces of paper, 11 blank, and one with the word Mazel Tov on it. In the other hat, they had 12 names. Each person who entered the raffle put his name on a piece of paper into the hat. Then they had a kid, a child, I'm not sure if that was a mystical belief or just convenient, like we do it today sometimes. They had a child, a boy or a girl, he says, would pull one paper from this hat and one paper from that hat, and most of the papers would be blank, and they would throw out those names. When finally, when they pulled out a Mazel Tov, whichever name came out of the other hat, he would get the prize. So it was on the second drawing that Mazel Tov came up, and somebody won the goblet. Somebody was suspicious. He thought that was a little too quick. He didn't think Mazel Tov should have come out quite so quickly. So he unwrapped the rest of the papers, And he saw there were actually two Mazel Tovs in there and only 10 blank papers. The Mazel Tov had been written twice. So the Chavos Yair voided the Goril and said, we're doing it again. We'll discuss why he did that in a minute. The other guy argued, I had no advantage. You know, the fact that it was a little bit irregular here, he says, it wasn't tilted. It didn't affect the odds of any one of us winning. Nevertheless, the Chavos Yair dismissed the Goril and had a redo, do-over. So they did the second Goril. This time it was on the sixth try that somebody won. Someone again decided, for some reason, just Fitumo, just playing around, looked at all the papers. This time, the mistake that happened was one of the 12 names had gotten left out of the hat. Only 11 names were entered. Now, that obviously is unfair. The guy who lost clearly has an objection. Clearly can object and say, that's not fair. You know, I paid my rechtailer. I deserve to be entered into this raffle. No problem. The guy who won quickly saw what was going on, so he made a deal with that guy. He said, look, you have a problem? I'll split it with you. I'll give you 4 rechtailer, he said. I'll pay you off to withdraw your objection. Nobody else has any reason to object. If anything, we all had a slightly increased chance of winning. And this guy, I paid off. So what's the problem? Chavos Yair said, nope, we need one more time. We need to do it over again. This one is also thrown out. Now, why would you do that? Now, he says he wasn't originally sure. I'm not sure why the second case was less clear to him than the first case. But in any event, his maskana, his conclusion is that both these raffles are voided. Both of them have to be redone. And the reason he gives is that even though you think there's no svari, he says, there's no makom le'error here in number 4, mitzad ha'seichel. Nevertheless, he says, he follows in the tradition of the Gaonim. He says the Goril is a mystic procedure that somehow does channel the will of God. And that's only if all the formalities are adhered to. As long as anything irregular is done, that somehow disturbs this process of channeling the mind of God, and the Goril therefore has to be thrown out. Now, very often when you read the legalese on a promotion, you see all kinds of thing about all kinds of small print on the bottom about how all this is at the discretion of us. We have the right to change the rules. We have the right to do whatever we want. All decisions made by us. That's done because of people like me following this Chavos Yair. The Kollel used to have a raffle, still does, I think. They have the weekly parsha sheet. There are questions. The kids answer the questions. They're entered into raffles. So about a year ago, my colleagues turned to me and said, you know, someone's paper got left out. It wasn't submitted properly. What do we do? I said, Chavos Yair, the whole Goril has to be voided. You have to go do the whole thing again. They're like, it's awkward. I'm like, I know. It's a problem. And similar problems would come up repeatedly. So I told them the solution to these problems are, that's what all the legalese is for, right on the bottom. We make a good faith effort to follow all the rules as we state. However, we have the full discretion to make any changes, any mistakes, whether done in good faith or carelessness or negligence, shall be binding. We are under no responsibility, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's not because because the people doing this are mean and they're out to get you. It's because there are problems and there are gotchas. And if you want to do things right, at least if, you know, coming from our perspective, the lawyers or the Chashem Mishpat people, the goal is not to promise more than you're prepared to deliver, even if that means adding a lot of disclaimers in front. This is the problem. Chavos Yair is very strict. Do we pass like this, Chavos Yair? It's hard to know. The Pesach Tshuva brings it, and there aren't that many poskim who explicitly reject it, and the Chavos Yair is an important authority. But he takes this very restrictive rule toward a Goril. Any deviation from the rules is going to invalidate the Goril, and corollary of that is anybody who paid money has the right to object. The Kollel's case, I don't think anyone's paying money for it, but nevertheless, if we make a promise and we make a commitment, then the Chavos Yair is telling us that we have to abound by all the formalities, even if it doesn't change the odds of anybody winning or not. It doesn't matter. The principle he establishes is that the Goril is some means of accessing the divine will, and any irregularities, anything that deviates from proper procedure is going to be a reason to throw out the whole Goril, and therefore either get it right, make sure you get it right, or make sure that you get buy-in from everyone that you have the right to deviate by accident or otherwise.
But is this like a nekatos? Is that?
Essentially, and in the case where people paid money, the idea is you paid money to have a fair chance, and even though probabilistically speaking your chance was fair, but the way the Chavos Yair is looking at it, when you paid money, you're entitled to get the divine will, and if you didn't get the divine will, you just got an arbitrary random outcome. That wasn't the plan. The plan was to do a Goril, which is tantamount to saying the plan was to consult a Kosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, and if you don't get that, then that wasn't what was promised, and therefore that seems to be how he understands it. Yes?
And he has to
Everything is a divine will, right? An interesting point. His language is Karav Adavar Shmagaro Kahogan Yidavik Bashkach El Yona. If it's done properly, then you'll get divine providence. The implication is the converse of that is if it isn't done Kahogan, you won't get divine providence. Maybe that itself is divine providence. The providence is to tamper with the procedures. An interesting question. Again, how the Chavos Yair knew all this is a general question. It doesn't seem absolutely compelling. And indeed, you know, Rav Chaim David HaLevi says he doesn't find this compelling, but yeah, it's not what I would have said, but this was the position of the Chavos Yair one way or another.
What's interesting is in medicine and trials, it's exactly the same.
With a box
of names and a box of verities.
All right.
So there
you go. Okay.
Division of the
arts
was done.
Right, so that's true. The reason the Chavos Yair, they were doing it this way, presumably, was because they were modeling as closely as possible. They were modeling their girl after the girl of the arts, right? Why they did it that way is, you know, it's difficult to know also. There's another aspect of girl. We're not going to get maybe too deeply into this today, but there's another aspect of girl, which is, forget the question of if it works and how it works. The question is, are you violating the prohibitions against the commandment to not parent to the occult, not engage in superstition or in occult practices to divine the future. There is a Sifri. We don't actually have the Sifri, but the Sifri is quoted by Tosfos. Apparently, some Rishonim had this in this Medrash. The Sifri says, Tamim Tiyam Hashem Elokecha, you shall not consult astrologers and you shall not consult lotteries. This is actually brought by the Shulchan Aruch and the Shach and Yardea and the General Simon, all the various, you know, multifarious prohibitions against engaging in occult practices and divination and all that, different kinds of prognostications. And one of them is you are not allowed to consult Gorolos. So what does that mean exactly? As we said, the Chavos Yair, we have a long tradition that Gorolos were used. In addition to the biblical ones, we know, for example, that the temple service on a daily basis, on Yom Kippur, was all done by the Kohen Gadol. But the question about who would get the privilege to perform the temple service, again, Mishnah Yoma tells us it was done by a Garol. A pious, they called it. The Achronim say that the custom was, we mentioned earlier, Chaim David HaLevi, but how to give out Elias. There was a common custom. Today, the custom in many shuls, maybe most shuls, is that Kaddish, let's say, is done by multiple people, although only one person davens for the Amud. How do you decide that? Or in some communities, Kaddish was only said by one person. How is that done? So one of the common procedures, the Achronim tell us, going back hundreds of years, was a garol. So in spite of the ruling in the Shulchan Aruch and the early poskim that we don't consult garolos, again, garol clearly was used from Chalukas Aretz down as a pretty standard method of resolving, again, equal claims that there's no way to differentiate. Inherently, there's no method to distinguish. We have to find a random method to distinguish. They use garol. So how is that allowed? Why does that not violate this Sifri, this ban on consulting Gorolos? And the answer, I think, the standard answer is pretty intuitive, what probably some of you are probably thinking. This is the point made by Rav Shlomo Kluger in number 5. He says that there's a difference between performing a Gorol to predict the future or for some kind of occult purpose, or simply, again, like the coin toss, simply to decide. We have no other way to decide, so that this is the best we can do. We need something to break the tie. So Rav Shlomo Kluger explains that the prohibition against Garol, against Ein Shalom B'Garolos, is only if you're actually trying to predict the future. If you're just trying to decide who should get some privilege, or who, that's fine. That's not occult. That's just some procedure for breaking a deadlock, and that is fine. And this actually takes us to the somewhat curious question of the so-called Garol Hagra. There is a well-known procedure called Garol Hagra. The scholars call this bibliomancy, magic performed by books, by looking things up in books, and by flipping books and somehow acting according to the passages that come up. And the Jewish version involves a Tanakh usually. So there are a number of famous stories, mostly 20th century stories. The famous ones are 20th century stories told about how major figures, world historical Jewish figures, made decisions based on a Garol, so-called Garol Hagra. It's not clear whether Garol Hagra has any connection to the Gra himself, the historical Gra, but this procedure called Garol Hagra, there are three famous stories I know of, three versions of a story, or three famous stories I know of involving Garl Hagra in the 20th century. In some circles, the famous one is one told about Rav Aryeh Levin. Simcha Raz tells us in his book, A Tzaddik in Our Time, that when they had the ambush of the soldiers relieving the Gush, I think, in 47, they recovered bodies, and they couldn't identify, after they were massacred, they couldn't identify who all the bodies were. So the story goes, Rav Aryeh Levin performed a Garl Hagra. Basically, each of the 13, I think, names that they couldn't identify, each of the 13 collections of remains, he did this flipping the Tanakh thing, and he ended up with a pasuk that clearly referenced the name, first or last name, of one of the 13 unidentified soldiers. Simcha Raz tells the story in great detail. If you want to know practical guidance how to do it, read his book. He'll tell you exactly how it's done, how many pages you flip, and so on. You do need, apparently, a very special Tanakh that he had. I'm not sure where to get a hold of it, but certain edition. But in any event, that was the story of Aryeh Levin identifying the remains of soldiers, associating them with missing people by the procedure of the Garl Hagra. In other circles, they tell the story about Rav Aaron Cutler, I think, that when he was leaving Europe and trying to decide whether to go to Eretz Yisrael or to the United States, someone performed some kind of Garl Hagra, and they ended up with the pasuk of Hashem told Aaron, the biblical Aaron, Parsha Shmos, Lech Likras Moshe Hamidbara, go to the wilderness to meet Moshe, meaning Moshe Feinstein, and together they did a great deal toward building Judaism in the United States. A third version of the story that appears in Dati Lumi circles is about the great Rosh Hashanah Yisraeli. The story goes, when he was a yeshiva student in Moscow behind the Iron Curtain, he and a friend were trying to decide whether to flee. They couldn't get visas. They couldn't get legal transit out of Moscow. So it was very risky, but they had some opportunity to sneak out or get themselves smuggled out. So they asked Rav Yaakov Klemis, I'm not sure, apparently a famous Muscovite Rav later in Eretz Yisrael. They asked him whether they should do it, whether they should risk their lives to get to Eretz Yisrael. And he did the Garl Hagra, and he ended with some pasuk about in Masse, I think, Venosef HaGvul, and the Gvul ends up in Eretz Yisrael, and he told them to go to Eretz Yisrael, and they did, and Rosh Hashanah Yisraeli became a major important figure in the Israeli rabbinate. But in any event, the Garl Hagra does go back centuries. If you look in some of the Kabbalistically inclined Akronim, the Chidah, in his Sfarim has numerous different accounts of different types of Garl Hagra procedures. He himself, at one point, discusses the question of why is this type of bibliomancy permitted? Why isn't this a problem of Shaul and Begarolos, of performing occult rituals to divine the future or to try to figure out the will of God? The basic answer seems to be, at least according to those who permitted it, that Torah is different. The Gemara already has various references to rabbis in the Talmud who did this. They went over to children. They said, "Psok li psukecha, tell me what pasuk you're learning." And the kid would say, sorry? The kid would say the pasuk, and they would somehow determine what course of conduct to take from that. So you see, Torah is different somehow. But in any event, the Garl Hagra is a somewhat obscure practice that there are apparently some serious sources within Judaism for, if not the Gra himself. And there are some 20th century sources. I don't know how reliable they are. But in general, the attitude of Rav Shlomo Kluger, I think, is the standard one, that using a Garl to predict the future, to kind of figure out what God wants, is problematic. Using a Garl simply as a tiebreaker to decide what should we do, we have no other means of resolving a deadlock, that is pretty well accepted.
However, this signal was not so much kind of by way of the Rebbe, who most of us thought had actually departed, his veil of tears already, but he was communicating. So, and of course we later found out that he was a Mashiachist. The procedure was called, he didn't clearly invent the procedure, apparently it was...
Right, you know, as you're saying, the procedure itself is apparently an old one. It has pretty, you know, well-documented sources, at least some form of it, going back several centuries. Obviously, different subcultures are able to put a different spin on it depending on their general belief systems. But one last topic I want to discuss. This is the question of turning to the Gorel of Yonah. In the case of Yonah, the sailors wanted to know why are we suffering from this terrible storm. They did a Gorel. It landed on Yonah. They asked him what happened. He explained to them, "I'm a Jew. I'm running from God." And eventually, they threw him into the water, and the storm subsided. Now, we should note, by the way, that both the Gorel of Achan as well as the Gorel of Yonah, and I think Yonason, in all these cases, after they did the Gorel, the person involved actually admitted his culpability. Achan admitted to Yeshua, Yonah admitted it. They weren't actually denying it. So whatever action was taken was taken. The Gorel kind of initiated a confession by the person himself. But with regard to the Gorel of Yonah, there is a fascinating and somewhat vigorous debate in the Achronim, going back centuries. Is this halacha l'maisa? If you are suffering and you're not sure whose fault it is, are you or samazeh, you're going on the sled and you have to throw somebody overboard to the wolves, can you use a Gorel to determine who has to be thrown overboard? So there's actually several hundred years of debate about this, about whether the procedure of Yonah can be applied halacha l'maisa in such situations. Now again, the arguments against are, first of all, Yonah admitted that it was his fault. Yonah was a Navi. Yonah knew that it was his fault. Yonah gave a pretty convincing, he was a Navi and he could convince them and he could explain to them exactly why this was happening. Additionally, there are Midrashim that say that it wasn't just the Gorel. The reason the sailors were so baffled by this, they saw all the other ships, according to the Medrash, were sailing calmly through the sea. Their ship was in a little squall, a little bubble that was following them around. Just a little terrible storm was pummeling them, and all the other ships were fine. According to the Medrash also, it says they started, the Psukim imply that they were very reluctant to throw Yonah in. According to the Medrash, they first dipped him in, and the storm calmed, then they pulled him out, and the storm reignited, and they dipped him in deeper, and stopped again, and they took him out. There was a whole mass, a tremendous mass of circumstantial evidence, of very strong circumstantial evidence, that was all pointing toward Yonah. So there are a lot of reasons why we're not going to simply learn halacha l'maisa from the story of Yonah. Additionally, some posts can point out, we don't know that they called up a Rav and asked a Shaila. These people were clearly well-meaning. They clearly were trying very hard not to kill an innocent man. According to the Gemara, they actually became proselytes afterward. They were so, they were so, it says they made Nadarim, which they became Geirim, according to Chazal. So these were clearly not your ordinary garden variety common sailors. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, they aren't halachic authorities from whom we necessarily have the right to derive normative halacha. So, you know, there are certainly many ways to reject the inference from Yoni that you're allowed to do this. But nevertheless, there are poskim who actually seem to learn halacha l'maisa that this would be the way to go in such a circumstance. Yes, exactly. So that's what I'm about to get to. So one of the primary comments on this topic, which brings up exactly that point, and number seven, is the Tiferes L'Moshe. He's going on that Gemara, on that din that you just mentioned, that it says that in general, if bad guys come and they want you to turn somebody over, it says that certainly you can't just arbitrarily turn someone over, even if they are Yichadu, even if they single out one, even then it's not so simple, according to one opinion, that's only if that person that they singled out is guilty, objectively guilty, like the case of Shev ben Bichri. He was married to Malchus. That's a complex sugya we're not going to get into today. But it's, you certainly can't make a decision to pick one on your own. And even if they single out one, it's not so clear that you can give them the one that, and even if they single out one, it's not so clear that you can give them the one that they want. So says it to Tiferes Lemoshe, you can't just do it on your own. But however, if you do a garul, and the garul singles out somebody, then that person can be turned over to solve the problem for everyone else. Now, many other achronim push back against this. Chazon Ish, for example, says, if that's so, then why would the Mishnah say, the Mishnah rules, if they come to you and say, give us one of them, then they all have to die. You can't turn anybody over. Very simple solution, just do a garul. Take a coin or take a pair of dice and do a garul. What's the big deal? Why would the Mishnah say, let them all die? There's a very simple solution according to the Tiferes Lemoshe. So the Chazon Ish very much strongly rejects this idea, as do other achronim. They say, it's clear from Chazal, garul is not a heter, Yonah is different for all the various reasons we've been discussing. You can't infer halacha l'maisa from Yonah. In general, in the case of the sled and the wolves and so on, you are not allowed to do a garul to throw somebody to the wolves or to the murderers. And the truth is, this really goes back to a contradiction in the Sefer Hasidim, a medieval authority. Sefer Hasidim has two separate passages where he discusses this general circumstance of the ship and you need to throw somebody over, and the question is, who? So in the first passage, he says that in the case of the ship, he has a bunch of different qualifications and conditions, but at the end of the day, he says you are allowed to throw somebody over. He adds, of course, if you have a small vessel or a lifeboat or a raft, he says, certainly you should first try to throw him into the raft rather than throwing him into the water. I think that goes without saying, but in principle, he says you are allowed to cast him over. Now, again, he does say it's only if you see, like Yonah, if other ships are sailing calmly, only your ship is a problem, you do it multiple times, and so on. But at least if certain conditions are met, at least in principle, he seems to allow you, in the first passage, to toss somebody over if necessary to save the rest of the ship. He has a second passage, however, in which he flatly says, no, you cannot do that. He says, can you do what Yonah did? He says, no. He says, makes an interesting argument. He says, asmachta lo kanya. Asmachta lo kanya basically means it's a law in the laws of contracts. It means that if two people agree to such a deal, which has a gambling component, the contract wouldn't be binding. That's a topic, again, for a separate discussion. But he basically invokes the laws of contracts to say that even if they would agree to these terms, everyone would voluntarily agree, we'll all do the garul, and whoever gets the short straw will die. Not binding, he says, and generally you can't write contracts dealing with people's lives anyway. But the bottom line is, in this tshuva too, he says that no such thing. Even in Dine Mamonos, he says, garul is only used to decide between equal things. He mentioned earlier, two plots of land, which are basically the same dimension, certainly the same value. Then you do a garul, he says. Garul is never used to decide life and death. So he says that you cannot do a garul. So this is pretty much a contradiction of these two passages. The Achronim have all kinds of different methods for trying to resolve when you do a garul, when you don't do a garul. Some of them say what we said before, that the first passage was dealing with extraordinary circumstances where all the other ships were not having a problem, only your ship is, and other conditions are met. In general, you don't do a garul, but there is no absolutely clear resolution. Many Achronim point out that it's a stira, and it's hard to know exactly what to do. We have contemporary tshuvas about this. There is a tshuva in the Sefer Kinyan Torah B'Halacha about a bunch of Jews studying Torah under Soviet Russia. And then they get raided. And they've prepared some kind of secret room for them to hide, but they underprepared, apparently. It's only room for half of them. So the question was, if they have time, I guess, in the few seconds before the KGB makes it up the stairs to hide half of them, are they allowed to use a garul to decide what to do? And he goes through all this literature, all these different sources. I don't remember his conclusion, I apologize, but he goes through all this literature trying to decide whether garul is a viable means to decide who lives or who dies, or in his case, I think it was who goes to jail, who goes to Siberia, and who gets away. We do have a handful of other tshuvas, though, that do take for granted that when there's no other means to determine what to do, and the alternative is lose-lose, everyone loses, then garul is the way to go. So, for example, we have a tshuva of Ramosha, the very last item on the page. Ramosha was discussing how to allocate scarce medical resources. Doctor. The doctor has to decide, you know, two patients need him. Maybe it's life and death for both of them. So what rules does he use to determine, what to do? So he gives various decision-making procedures. First come, first serve, he says, who's closer? There are other rules, he says, in Harayos to decide who is more worthy of being saved. Not going to get into that today. But at the end of the day, he says, if none of these rules will determine, none of these rules control, you're still left with two equally reasonable possibilities. Ramosha says, Ramosha just takes for granted, casually tosses out, that if the doctor doesn't know, or if I guess there's nothing to distinguish between them, yigarl, kainera. Do a garl. The doctor flip a coin, basically. If you don't know what to do, you know, Bjorn's ass. If you don't do anything, then the astro starves. You can't decide whether to go to two big piles of food. Then you have to have some procedure to break a deadlock. It makes no sense that everyone should die, so do a garl. Earlier, a couple of centuries earlier, we have a tshuva of the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer was talking about a very dark chapter in Jewish history, the Cantonists, the Chappers, when the Russian government used to demand quotas of draftees, kids even, young Jewish males, to go to the army for 25 years. And I'm not sure which era exactly the Chasam Sofer was talking about, but he was talking about one of these cases where the government was drafting, I'm not sure if this was the Russian one or an earlier gzera like this, that the government was drafting, and the government, instead of drafting individuals, would often go to the community and say, your village has to produce 10 soldiers or 50 soldiers. So the terrible responsibility that the local Jewish government would have to do to produce people. And apparently, history tells us this is often abused, that the rich and the powerful, 'twas ever so, you know, somehow were able to sometimes maneuver the burden onto the poor. So the Chasam Sofer has an outraged tshuva decrying the practice, that this is outrageous and unacceptable and so on. And what should you do, the Chasam Sofer says, we have no choice, we have to provide someone. If we don't, then I guess worse things are going to happen. So the Chasam Sofer again resorts to the garl. He says, the only solution I have for you, he says, is garl. What should you do? Everyone who's eligible should appear. They should conduct a garl. Whoever the garl falls on, he himself, then he's the meaning one draft. If he can get away, if he can pay somebody off, then fine, he says. If he can pay somebody else, we discussed the idea of surrogates. Chasam Sofer seems to take for granted he's allowed to hire a surrogate. He discusses why that's okay, he says. But the rule is the garl controls. Instead of chas v'shalom, the powerful, seizing and turning over the powerless, he says, the only thing to do, he says, is to do a garl. So that, I think, is the standard position. So I think you have to make a distinction between the cases, let's say, of throwing someone over the ship and these types of cases. Throwing someone over the ship, you're biadayim, halacha often makes this distinction, you're actively causing harm to befall somebody else. That's not okay. Even if that means everyone will come to harm, you can actively destroy somebody else. In these cases, though, it's the opposite. Shev al tasif. If you don't do anything, at least, let's say, in the case of Ramosha, for sure. In the case of Ramosha, if the doctor doesn't go anywhere, then both patients die. That's clearly not a good idea. So garl is the best solution. The Chasam Sofer's case is a little worse, because if you're going to do this garl against somebody's will and you're then going to turn that guy over, you essentially are turning somebody over to the government. So you have to understand why that's really any better than the case of the ship, of throwing someone into the ocean. It wasn't literally life and death over there. Maybe that was different. I'll call upon him. In the case of the ship, many posts came up pretty reluctant, or in the case of the bandits who say, give us one and we'll kill him, and you're going to actually turn somebody over to be killed. The Tiferes Lemoshe notwithstanding, many other posts were very reluctant to allow the use of a garl to allow, again, because we don't believe that the garl is necessarily the will of God as we began, or because that's nice, but you can't kill somebody based on these types of arguments. And Yonah was a special case. Yonah, he was a Navi, and so on, and maybe they didn't do the right thing necessarily. Rav Avadya argues that just because they were well-meaning people doesn't mean necessarily that we have to agree that they were halachic experts. So to actually throw somebody overboard, to kill somebody, be a daim, is something poskim are not willing to really countenance. When it comes to just deciding which way a doctor should go, then it seems it'd be a much stronger argument to make that what else are you going to do? If you don't do the garl just to stay home, really doesn't make any sense. You're not helping anybody by doing that. And so you would do a garl to decide which way to go. There's that, as we mentioned, the garal is used in the case of shutfus. In the case of partnership, we have to divide. We have to divide assets, and see, so first you parcel up the land into two equal parts, ideally equal in dimensions and everything. If that doesn't work, at least equal in value. You adjust. You put, let's say, balance out with some cash or something, until you have two equal in value parcels. The Erech Shai makes the point, or Shlomo Yehuda Tabak makes the point. He says, let's say there are two pieces of real estate. You can't cut them up. One of them is worth $200,000, and one of them is worth $400,000. So he says, so what are you going to do? See, cut them up is not practical. They're houses. You can't just chop them in two. You can sell them, I guess, and you can divide the cash if that's. But let's say they want to keep the property itself. So are you going to do a garal? Says Erech Shai, no, you're not going to do a garal, because money is always fungible. So even if the houses themselves are not, but the cash value is. So what you would do is, one partner would say, for example, you take the $400,000 one, and I'll take the $200,000 one, and you give me $200,000 in cash to make it up, or vice versa. So you'll use cash. If the state doesn't have enough cash, then you'll introduce cash by one of the two to balance it out. If even after that, even after they balance it out into two $400,000 parcels, they still can't work out which one should be the one to take the cash plus the house or the bigger house, at that point he says, again, you're going to have to do a garal. He says, but usually it's not going to work out like that. Usually he says one party is going to want the house and he'll pay a little bit more money or less money. But in principle, again, he makes the point, garal is only used, you don't use a garal to kill one person, let one person live. Garal is only used when the two things are basically equal. You just have to find the two things are equal in value. You just have to decide who gets this one, who gets that one. Then you do a garal. But who should live and who should die, that you never use a garal. The Kaddish, he says, those types of things, they use a garal, he says, because the Kaddish is not really an asset. Nobody really owns it, and so on. Other reasons, he says. But in general, garal is never used to give somebody, the lucky winner, more than the other party. Garal is used to decide between two options that you made as equal as possible. Now you just have to decide they aren't literally identical. Then you use garal to decide which is which. But as long as the two things are not equal, then garal's not the solution. You first try to equalize them out by using money, and only then, only after you've done everything you can to make the two things equal, at that point, then you use garal, as you did in the case of the Chalukas Haaretz, and as you did in the case of the Shnei Se'irim, where the two Se'irim are exactly equal. According to Chazal, they were the same height, and the same, they look the same and everything. Then you use the garal. Sefer Chassidim himself really makes this point. He says that because you're going to do with the garal, that's why Chazal tells us the Se'irim had to have Shavim v'Mare v'Koma. They look the same. They were the same height. Because again, garal is only used to decide between functionally equivalent possibilities, but life and death, that you don't use a garal to distinguish between.